All right, so welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. It's good to have you all here. We are recording this for the podcast, so I'll be taking questions at the end. We're excited to have you here. We've made this Literary Salon as a hub for writers in the D.C. area. You are the 182nd author I've interviewed since we've been here.
If you go to
elainesliterarysalon.com, you can sign up for our newsletter, and you can see some of our previous podcasts. We're number one on Spotify, and we're number three or four on Apple right now. So check us out. It's really fun. Jennifer Vanderkloot is an award-winning former journalist of both print and digital publications, including the D.C. affiliate of ABC 7 News. A graduate of San Jose State University, she spent most of her life in the San Francisco Bay Area before moving to the Northern Virginia suburbs of D.C., where she currently lives with her husband and two sons. For nearly a decade, she was the lead singer of the Bay Area-based band Sweet Duration and performed with artists like Jason Mraz, Big Country, Chantal Kreviazek, is that right?
Yeah, Kreviazek.
Kreviazek? Okay, thank you. Thanks for throwing that one in there. I appreciate it. And Stabbing Westward. When she's not writing, she loves going to the beach with her family, going to concerts with her girlfriends, and getting lost in the pages of a book. I think we met at BoucherCon last year.
We did, yes. I was the timekeeper for your panel.
Oh, that was wonderful. The panel where my moderator didn't show up and I had to take over.
Right.
Yes, that was always fun. Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. It's really good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, congratulations on your book. It's a really big deal. This is your debut.
It is, yes.
People don't realize how hard it is to get a book across the finish line, especially to traditionally publish a book.
Yes.
I mean, the numbers are ridiculous, but you know, it's over 80% of people say they have a book in them, and only 3% ever start, and only 1% ever finish. And then the numbers of that 1% who get traditionally published is so infinitesimally small, it doesn't make sense to talk about.
Every day I think I'm going to wake up and be like, that was a really awesome dream. If only that could really happen.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your book with no spoilers.
No spoilers. Okay. It's called The Better Mother. So it's a thriller and it's about Savannah. She doesn't find out that she's pregnant until after she's already broken up with the father, whose name is Max. When she gets back in touch to tell him, she finds out that he's already gotten back together with one of his other exes. And he says, I need to be honest with her and tell her about this. But, you know, I do want to be in the child's life. A couple of weeks later, he says, I've talked to her about it. She was upset at first, but now she's, you know, just really wants to be supportive of us. And she wants to meet you so we can get all the awkwardness out of the way from the beginning. So they meet, and at first Madison, his girlfriend, seems very nice, very supportive, very helpful. But as time goes on, crazy things start to happen in Savannah's life. It kind of seems like someone's trying to sabotage her and make her look like an unfit parent. Naturally, the number one suspect would be Madison, but she can't prove any of it. So the book deals with, is Savannah crazy? Is Madison really doing this to her? If so, why? And what's really going on? And it gets to a pretty frightening conclusion.
So the one question that like all authors get all the time at every conference is like, where do you come up with your ideas? And but I'm always curious because there's usually something that sparks the idea. Where did this come from?
It's kind of a funny story, actually. Anyone who likes to read Reddit, random Reddit posts, there is a popular thread called Am I the Asshole? And it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. It's like an advice column of sorts. People write up and they say, you know, I'm having a conflict with another person. Here's my side of the story. Here's what their side of the story is. Which one of us is the asshole in this situation? And they're so dramatic. They're so just full of drama. And, you know, I'm always just like, wow, there's nothing crazier than real life. You know, you hear about these real life problems and it would be hard to imagine anything crazier. And I came across a post one time from a woman who said, I'm pregnant with twins and I'm not together with the father anymore. And he's already moved on and married someone else by the time I got in touch to tell him. And she says, you know, am I the asshole or, you know, is what's going on here? Because the father's wife is just being very overbearing. She's picking out names. She's posting on social media, like, not even mentioning me, saying, like, you know, surprise, we're having a baby. And, you know, not mentioning that it's actually the other woman having the baby. And she even went so far as to throw a bridal shower, a baby shower for herself and didn't invite the mother, you know, acting like she's the one having the baby. And obviously the mother was getting concerned. She's like, you know, should I be worried about this? Should I be glad that, you know, they want to help and, you know, I'm not going to have to do this alone. But it was a long diatribe. And at the end of it, there was violence happening and I was just riveted. I was like, oh my gosh, that's the craziest situation I've ever heard of. And that would make an amazing thriller book. And she even came back after a while and did an update on the post. I love it when they come back after a while and update it. And she said, like, yeah, I had to get a restraining order. I had to move out of the state and all of these crazy things. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, get away from this woman. She sounds crazy. And
in the real life, what did the father do? Because that is crazy behavior.
She didn't say much about the father other than that he was just kind of unhelpful, you know, caught between the two of them saying like, I know she's a little overbearing and a little coming on strong, but she just wants to help. And so that's kind of where Max comes from in my book is that, you know, you never really know, does he believe her? Does he not believe her? Does he really know that she's doing these things or not? So it just made the great basis for a novel. I kind of took it, you know, to the extreme, you know, what would make someone do these things? What would make them believe that they're justified in doing this? And coming up with the backstories for everybody. And then, you know, just the crazy, it has a pretty crazy ending. So,
I mean, it's such a great premise. I'm curious, like with this discussion board, is it like a Dear Abby thing where there's the moderator who's sort of like the arbiter of what's crazy? Are you the asshole or not? Right. Or is it like a crowdsource thing where everyone's just chiming in?
Yeah, it's kind of a crowdsource thing. There's the OP, original poster. And then, you know, everybody, I mean, they get thousands of comments, people writing in being like, oh yeah, you're the asshole in this situation. How could you do this? Or, oh my gosh, girl, these people are crazy. Get away, run. Everybody puts in their opinion. And some lawyers started chiming in saying like, you know, I really suggest you move out of state before the babies are born because, you know, the custody situation. And at first, it seemed like there was nothing she could do because there had been no violence. So there was no basis for a restraining order. But then eventually there was. And so she was able to get that restraining order and just kind of like, gosh, what do you do when no one believes you about that someone's doing these things to you? It was just crazy. Gaslighting, stalkering.
I mean, it's such great fodder, right? And the author in me is thinking, like, what a great place to, like, kind of crowdsource opinions on plot ideas. Just putting stuff up there and seeing
exactly
how people react to it.
It's, I mean, I used to just read it just for fun and that, but that one really stuck with me. And I was kind of tossing around the idea of, should I try writing a novel? And when I read that post, it was like, boom, like lightning struck, like, I could see the beginning, the middle, the end. I could see just the whole story in an instant. And that's how I knew that was the idea to go with.
Oh, I love that. So you're really hitting like domestic suspense, like a bullseye, right? Like that's spot on for domestic suspense. It's also a thriller, right? So how, like when you're writing this, are you thinking about the genres and the reader expectations? Like what tropes did you want to avoid or include?
The one thing that was important to me was that it wouldn't be seen as like a motherhood book or a mommy thriller. You know, while it does deal with, you know, a pregnancy, the book goes over the span of about 8 or 9 months from when she finds out she's pregnant till the end of the pregnancy. It's not about being a mother or what it's like to carry a child or anything like that. It's more to do with, you know, personal relationships, how women can be very competitive sometimes, how they can compare themselves to other people. And then just, you know, the whole idea of gaslighting and, you know, how do I get people to believe me? He's making me feel like I'm crazy, but I'm not crazy. And so it was just really great to play with the psychological aspect of that.
So like when it's going from this like idea conception and you're like, okay, these are the feelings I want to evoke in the reader. How is it going from idea to story? Like you said, you had the whole thing in your head. Like as soon as you saw it, you knew the ending. Are you breaking it into like a 3-act structure in your head, or like what is that process like for you? Are you sort of just writing and seeing how things fit together, like following the characters? What's the process with that?
That's an interesting question because, you know, I know the whole pantser versus plotter debate. With The Better Mother, I definitely outlined a lot of it ahead of time. And that kind of gave me the confidence. I didn't feel like I was going into it blind, especially being my first book. I'd never even tried writing a book before I tried this one. So, but then with my second book, I was like, oh, everybody makes pantsing sound like it's so fun. Like you just go into it by the seat of your pants and you just start writing. And I tried doing that and it really didn't work very well for me.
It's terrifying. I tried it once too. It's horrible.
Yeah. I can't do that. I ended up going off in just so many tangents. It ended up, I think, like 150,000 words, and I had to cut so much of it. And I was like, nope, I'm going to be an outliner from now on. That's much better.
I mean, it's like, do whatever works, right? But I've talked to so many pantsers here. I know David McCloskey was sitting right here, and he cut 40,000 words out of the book I was interviewing him about. That's crazy, right? Like, that's a lot of
work. Yeah, I ended up having to cut like 25-40% of the book. I had a whole chapter about Savannah trying to decide whether or not she should get a dog. Like, while that may be interesting, it's probably not necessary for the story.
Unless the dog did it, right?
Right. Unless the dog didn't do it.
So I'm curious, like, about your whole debut experience. Like, how long did this take you to write?
Well, once I actually went to a writing workshop, once I kind of had the idea, I was like, you know, I should really, you know, like run this by people who know what they're talking about. And like, is this, you know, actually a good idea? Do I think I could do it? I went to this 5-day writer's retreat and it was a wonderful experience. It was the Algonquian Writer's Workshop run by Michael Neff. And it was in Sterling over 5 days, and we had plenty of time to write and, you know, work on our own. But then he also brought in a lot of guest speakers. I had no idea what a literary agent even was or even did. So they brought one in one day, and she's like, well, once you write this thing and you're ready to shop around, this is what you need to do. This is how you write a pitch letter, all of that stuff. And then Michael really worked with me a lot and helped me outline the novel. And once I had that outline, the first draft only took me about 5 months because, you know, it was like I really knew each step, like where I was going. But then I spent about a year revising it, showing it to beta readers and agents and getting feedback before I was ready to start querying.
What surprised you about that process? Because, you know, everyone has this idea of, oh, I read books. How hard could it be, right? And then you get into it and you're like, oh my God, this is incredibly hard.
Yeah. The hardest part for me is just how long-winded I am and how much I ended up having to cut. But I had no idea how literary agents work. It's like when, you know, when somebody thinks like, oh, I want to be an actor or an actress, you know, it's like, but how do you get discovered? You just like do scenes on the corner of a street and hope somebody sees you, or like, how do you even do that? And it was really comforting to learn about the whole system, about, you know, like signing up for Query Tracker, and people will say what they're looking for, and then you just click submit and send it to them, and then you just wait and hope that you get a response. And so learning all of that, I was like, oh great, there's a structure, there's a system, I'll go for it. And that's how I ended up getting an agent, is, you know, just through the regular channels of, you know, responding to manuscript wish lists and what agents were looking for, and just submitting through Query Manager. And it was just a cold query, the slush pile, I guess.
So how did what about the decision before that to go traditional or to self-publish? A lot of people want to self-publish, and that's their first thought. Why go traditional? Because the odds, I think it's 1 out of every 4,000 queries that an agent actually takes. So it's tough.
I tried not to think about that. really, I was, you know, I wasn't opposed to the idea of self-publishing, but I was like, I at least want to give querying and trad publishing a try and see how it goes. And, you know, if really, if nobody is biting, then, you know, maybe I will self-publish. But I was really surprised at just how fast it happened. I only queried for about 3 months. And then we were only on sub with the Better Mother for 2 months before we got our first offer. And I was just blown away because, you know, you read, I was obsessed with reading, other people's like interviews and their tweets and their blogs and reading all about their experiences and what it was like, and just seeing that it can take so long. You know, you can be on sub for a year or more, and I was prepared for it to be that long. And I don't know why I got picked up so quickly, but it happens, and it's amazing.
So we have a lot of writers that watch this. So I want to dig into it a little bit. Like how many agents did you go out to, and did you do it all at once, or was it a little at a time?
Yeah, I read a lot of blogs, a lot of advice that say, like, you know, don't blanket query 100 people all at once, because if there is a problem with your manuscript, you know, you want to have the chance to fix it. So, you know, I would do like maybe 10 or 15, wait and see if I would get any responses. And if a lot of people were saying the same thing, like, oh, I have a problem with this, then it's like, oh, I can fix that, and then send out another 15 queries or so. So I tried to follow that. I probably did like about 15 at first, and then I would, you know, start working on, you know, revising just in case. You know, I had a few ideas that, like, oh, people might not like this or people might not like that. So I kind of revised my pitch letter and everything, and then I might send out like another 5, and then I would pour over the query tracker update emails and be like, oh, this person just opened up and they want thrillers, or like people always say, look at the acknowledgments in the books that you like and see who their agents and editors are. It pretty quickly, I think I had about 8 full manuscript requests out.
That's remarkable, by the way. That really is remarkable. That's very unusual.
Oh, wow. And I was just like waiting. The agent I ended up signing with, Jenna Satterthwaite of Storm Literary, she was a fairly new agent. And, you know, and I read a lot of different opinion pieces on that as well. Like, do you want to sign with someone who's brand new? They may not have the contacts necessary. They may, you know, they don't have the experience. Editors are maybe they're less likely to, you know, take a new brand new agent seriously. But I kind of followed her on social media for a while and just saw, I loved how she spoke about her clients. She, you know, always had such great things to say about them. She never said anything negative. And I saw pretty quickly she was signing lots of deals with pretty decent sized publishers. And I mean, in her first 6 months, she signed a 6-figure deal with a big 5 publisher for one of her clients. And so I was like, why not? You know, I got from her was that she'd be a really great person to work with. And so I did. And as soon as she opened up, I knew I wanted to query her, and I did. And it was just, I don't know, just fate, I guess. She ended up requesting the full, and then within a couple weeks, she wanted to schedule a call with me, and it all just happened really quickly.
So in the call, like, what kind of questions did you ask the agent? Like, because, yeah, it's a relationship, right? So you have to know, like, communication style and querying,
yeah,
what is their submission strategy, all that kind of thing. What, how did that call go?
And as my husband and my friends would probably tell you, I am a very kind of type A control freak when it comes to that kind of stuff. It's very hard for me to hand my baby over to another person and just trust that they're going to take care of it and I have no part in it. That was really tough for me. I'm used to being out there and hustling and trying to find everything for myself and never depending on other people. And so one of the things she said in the call that I really loved was that she has like a Google spreadsheet, and she's like, I'm going to show you upfront. These are the 20 people I'm going to send your manuscript to start with. And she's like, give me feedback. You know, if there are any on here that you don't like, or if there are some that you were really hoping for that you don't see, just let me know. But she's like, these are people that I have relationships with and that I think your manuscript would be a good fit for. And I said, awesome. And she's like, you will, with me, you will never have to wonder what's going on, because I'm going to update the spreadsheet. And if you're curious what's happening, all you have to do is log into Google and check the spreadsheet in real time for updates. And that was so comforting to me, because I've seen so many other authors who are like, oh, it's been 3 months. I haven't heard anything. I don't know what's going on. Are people liking it? Are people not liking it? Like, that would drive me nuts. I would not be able to handle that. So I love just being able to kind of log in and see like, oh, this person got back. They said no because of this. Like, she would just cut and paste exactly what their feedback was in there. And I loved that. And I figured out that with Google spreadsheets, you can set a notification so that you'll get an email when anything has changed. So I didn't have to log in 20 times a day. Like, I would check my email 100 times a day instead, I guess.
That's the number one complaint with authors, the lack of communication.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I always write that into the contracts that they'll share all that. And I want to see the responses.
Exactly.
So when you went out on submission, did you have multiple offers or interest from multiple publishers?
Crooked Lane, who published The Better Mother, they were the first to offer. As soon as they did, two other publishers who had interest kind of chimed in at the same time. So technically it was an auction, although I think Crooked Lane kind of scared the other ones away. So they ended up being the last man standing.
So what was it about Crooked Lane that made you want to go with them?
They offered. I'm just kidding.
I mean, did you talk to like the acquiring editor? Did you get a feeling for if they wanted to change things with the book? Like, that's, I've known a lot of authors with these publishers, and sometimes that can be a sticking point too, right? If they want to make major revisions.
And my agent had actually done one other deal with them before. So that was really good to know that she had a working relationship with them. We got on the phone. I think it was like New Year's Day or the day after. And she's like, you know, I think it's great. I love this. I love that. She's like, the only changes I would envision are these couple things here. She's like, if you're, you know, open to changing those things, then we'd like to make an offer. And I absolutely agreed with the things that she brought up, which was great. I'm always of the philosophy, like, I don't think my word is golden or anything. Like, I'm not saying I'm not above needing to make improvements or taking anyone's suggestions or anything. I'm always like, if it's going to make the story better, whether it's your idea or mine, like, let's work together. I'm all about making changes. So I felt really good about that. And then the other two publishers that were interested, I did not get as strong of a feeling of that. And it also kind of seemed like they really wanted to rush the timeline. And Crooked Lane, you know, I always, you know, if you ever read Publishers Marketplace, you know, it's like, oh, it's going to come out 2.5 years from now. And I'm always like, oh my gosh, that must be crazy. You know, you finally get that yes, that someone wants to buy your book. And then they're like, your book will come out in 3 years. And I'm always like, why does it take so long? I don't understand. But now that I've been through it once, I absolutely understand why it takes that long. And actually, Crooked Lane's process was only 15 months. So that was pretty fast compared to a lot of others. But you know, the time it takes to do those changes and then to copy edit. And then it's like thinking ahead to marketing, so many things you have to put into play 6 to 9 months out at least. Like, if you want to be in this literary festival, you have to apply over 6 months out. If Good Morning America wants to pick you up, it's like 9 to 12 months out. Not that I'm thinking Good Morning America, but just knowing that, like, if you don't have that much lead time, it's not even an option, you know? So, I liked that Crooked Lanes wasn't unnecessarily long, but it also wasn't rushed either, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of self-published authors or small presses don't get that it really takes a long time to get into the right contests and the distribution arm. You have to get into like the seasonal meetings,
exactly.
You don't see and try to get bookstores on board. It takes a long time.
It does. And now that I've been through it, I'm like, this whole process is teaching me to be a more patient person, because it's like, I can't rush editors reading my book and or agents or making up their minds. You know, I can't rush, you know, knowing if I'm going to get into that festival or that person's going to want me to come to their bookstore. Like, I just have to put all the feelers out there, and then I just have to trust that what is meant to happen will happen. And so I'm sure my husband would agree. It's good. it's a good thing for me to learn a little more patience.
How many editing iterations did you have? Like, when you signed with them, you sent it to them, like how long did that process go, and how many times were you back and forth?
Actually, only once. In my original draft, I never really specified where the story took place. So one change that they wanted was, they're like, pick a location and then kind of weave that into the story, like at least name like some landmarks, some things. And I don't know why I had trouble thinking where would be the best setting for the story. And then when she made the suggestion of the San Francisco Bay Area, I was like, why didn't I think of that? That's where I grew up. I spent 30 years there. Like, I know every which way to get around the Bay Area. Obviously, that was the right choice. You know, I wanted it to be somewhere where she was in a city that was, you know, it was mostly walkable, you know, not a lot of great parking, you know, not a lot of great public transportation, somewhere where she would find herself, you know, walking to work, walking home from work, walking to a restaurant at night, that type of thing. So San Francisco made sense for that, but then I also knew all the surrounding areas. So, like, you know, where her mother lives, where this happens, that happens. So it just made sense. I kind of left it ambiguous in my original version.
So other than, like, you know, the structural element of that, with just being able to fit with the plot, like, how important is that setting for, like, mood or tone? And was your publisher interested in that because they wanted readers to be able to better put themselves in the place of your protagonist?
I think so. Yeah. She said, I just kept referring to it as the city. And she's like, you need to identify what the city is. And then it made sense. And now it's great because I hear from so many people who are like, oh, I love that it takes place in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, that's where I grew up, or that's where I live now. And I recognize this place that you mentioned, and that place, and this park, and that restaurant, and being my hometown, like, it was wonderful. And I got to travel out to San Francisco to do some launch events for the debut. And so it was a perfect suggestion.
Yeah, readers will tell me they go on, like, Google Earth and they'll look at the locations.
Exactly.
Like, people really do love that.
Yeah. I did that too when trying to figure out how to describe the apartment that she lived in. You know, those old Spanish style walk-ups in San Francisco are great. And some of them are so big, and then they separate them into little apartments. And so that worked perfectly for my main character, Savannah. So I looked at lots of those on Google Earth, and then when I got to go out there and see them all, it was wonderful.
Since this was your first book, like, how secretive were you with, like, friends and family? And, like, when you were writing it, were you, like, a lot of writers will just sort of keep it to themselves because they're not sure they're going to finish. What was your experience?
I'm not good at that. I'm not bad. Yeah. Everyone in the audience is shaking their head. No. I yap everyone's ear off about it. The only place I was secretive about it was at work. I didn't want them to think that I was, like, writing on company time. And I was like, yeah, my son's in, like, a Lego thing, so I can't work this week. And that's when I, like, flew to New York to take some meetings with, I did some live pitch events and things. I didn't want them to think that. So they were the only ones I was really secretive with, but everybody else, as they would tell you, I talked their ear off about it for several years.
So did you enjoy the process of writing? Because I've talked to writers who, they like having finished, you know, they like the final product, but they agonize through every step of the way, and they have all the imposter syndrome and, you know, all the bad things. But then others just love the creative moment and the using your imagination. And what's your experience when you're actually writing this?
I really enjoyed the process. The number of times I had to rewrite it and revise it was a little maddening towards the end, but it was always for a good reason. Like I said, you know, if it's a good idea, I am all about, yes, let's implement that. It's going to make the story better. It's going to make it more propulsive or suspenseful, or that one little element of the backstory that I never thought of, like, yes, let's, so, So the actual work could get tedious sometimes, but once you have that idea, that spark that like, that's what it needs, that's what it's been missing, oh, I finally figured it out, there's nothing like it. And going back and adding that in, it was great.
So tell us about that moment when you had your first box of author books that arrives and you can finally hold your imagination in your hand. What's that like?
That was crazy. Several people here in the audience were there that day when I got that box. Seeing it in physical form is just like nothing else. I can't even explain it. But and actually listening to the audiobook for the first time was even more emotional for me than seeing the book. Seeing when I listened to the first version of the audiobook and heard her say my name and then heard her give a voice to this character that's been in my head all this time, that was incredibly emotional. I think the audiobook was the craziest part of all of it.
Now, when someone else is reading your words back to you, are you hearing it like a reader, or it's a weird experience, right? Like do you feel like just every other time you've listened to an audiobook, or are you anticipating what's coming? Like explain that as an author.
Yeah, I did kind of listen to it just as a reader. I remember, I only got it maybe a week or two before the book came out. So I was like in a real rush. I wanted to hear the whole thing before it came out. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll do chores or I'll be cooking or doing this and that. And I would find myself getting sucked into it. And I'm like, oh, this is so exciting. Hopefully this is how readers will feel. And especially when we would get to a part where like I would make a joke or I wrote something sarcastic, and then to hear her say it exactly the way I imagined it in my mind, I was like, yes, you know, she said that joke exactly the way I wanted it to be. Or, you know, she made that, you know, the way she described that eye roll or something else. I was like, just to hear her say it exactly the way I meant it to be was really exciting.
And what's the experience like of going out in public like this and talking about your book and having people you don't know reading it and then making comments online? Like what is that like for you?
I mean, I'm getting a little more used to it now. But oh my gosh, when the advanced reader copies first went up on NetGalley, that was the only little beef I had with my publishers that they didn't tell me that was happening. And so someone would write me on Instagram and be like, oh, I just got your ARC through NetGalley and I can't wait to start reading it. And I was like, what? Like, I didn't even know it was out yet. And I'm like, I was not mentally prepared for this. And I remember I was, you know, talking to my friends and my family. I was like, just let the first review be nice. I know there are going to be some bad ones. There's not a book in history that's ever not had bad reviews. I know they're coming. Just let the first one be nice. The first one from a stranger anyway. And it was, and I cried. The first review from a stranger, it was so glowing. It was amazing. I was just like, okay, I can die happy now.
So do you go into Amazon and look at your reviews now?
I shouldn't, but I do. Yeah. I don't know. Having formerly been a journalist, when I started out in print newspapers, when I switched to digital news, you know, every news website, you know, you have no control over it. People can comment, people can say whatever they want. I used to get some really nasty comments from people all the time. And I used to get hate mail, all of that as a reporter. And I think my husband will tell you, like, yes, they all really bothered me. And my husband could never understand why it bothered me so much. He was just like, if you're not pissing people off, then you're not writing anything interesting. So that kind of stuck with me. And going into this, I'm just like, I've written bad reviews of books. You know, I know that my book is not going to be for everyone. So I kind of tried to prepare myself. And so I'm actually very proud of myself at how I've been dealing with the bad reviews. There have been a lot. Not as many as the good ones, though, but I think I'm learning to roll with the punches with that. You know, like, okay, if this person said they didn't even finish it, well, then no one cares what you have to say.
If you ever feel bad about it, just pick some of your favorite books and go and look at the 1-star reviews for like masterpieces.
There's always someone who hates it.
When
people on Instagram will do that, they'll be like, you know, 1-star reviews of something like The Book Thief, or like you know, Pride and Prejudice or something. And I'm like, or even like a current one, like Fourth Wing or The Correspondent, you know, you'll look at the 1-star reviews and be like, okay, yeah, see, it's not for everybody, and that's okay. So I've gotten better at that. But when I see the good ones, it just makes my day. It's so amazing. And especially when people pick up on little, like some of the more subtle themes that you're trying to do. A lot of people say that my main character, Savannah, you know, is kind of naive, maybe not the smartest, because she ignores a lot of red flags in the beginning that she should have picked up on. But I just did another podcast a few days ago. And when she said she really related to that, because she was like, as women, we're born to be people pleasers. You know, we don't always speak up and say exactly what we think. We're really good at keeping the peace, especially when it comes to family. Like, everyone has that relative that is super annoying. And, you know, but you would never say that to them because they're family. You know, if family does something that bothers you, you know, it's not always easy to speak up. And so I love that she picked up on that Savannah was really trying to keep the father of her child in her child's life. And so she probably put up with a lot more than she should have in the beginning. But then I loved, and that's why character arcs are great. You know, as the book goes on, she learns to gain more confidence. And you know, when she starts feeling her baby kick for the first time, it's like that mama bear instinct kicks in. And then it's like, okay, I'm not going to put up with anybody threatening my child. And she really grows more of a backbone and learns how to fight back. And so I really love that. A lot of negative reviews will say that, you know, she was just an idiot, or she was, you know, too naive or dumb in the beginning, but they just don't get it. And that's okay. But there are a lot of people out there that do. And those are my people.
Well, that character arc is what you're supposed to do. I'm curious.
Exactly.
Like,
that's why when someone says they DNF at like 20%, I'm like, then you have no idea what you're talking about. DNF means do not finish. So yeah. I'm like, you have no idea.
I'm curious, like, how you put these characters together, you know, because you have these fairly deep characters, right? And like, so you had the great premise to begin with, and you had the sort of fully formed plot idea, and then you have to populate it. Like with Savannah, how did that character grow? Like even before you started writing, like how do you populate like a character sketch, or you know, what is it you do to create this character?
Well, I think it actually started with a villain. I kind of built her first. That's one of the reasons why thrillers and mysteries are just they'll always be my favorite genre. I read a little bit of everything, but they're always my favorite because you take that bad guy and you're like, what's going on in their head? You know, what would make them think that they're entitled to this or that they should have this? What would make them think that they could get away with doing all these crazy things? And, you know, what makes them feel justified? And that's always the most fascinating part to me. So I think I kind of started with the villain, like what would make her kind of go after Savannah and think that she would be a better mother than her, and those kinds of things. And then, you know, and then I just kind of imagine, well, okay, if someone was doing that to me, how would I react? And so I think I relate with Savannah a little more. Like I said, you know, she's kind of a people pleaser. She's always trying to keep the peace. So she tries to avoid confrontation and everything. But then at a certain point, you're just like, okay, this is too much. I'm going to fight back. And then trying to come up with their backstories is just one of my favorite things. Like, oh, well, maybe she grew up without a father. And so having the father in her child's life is something that's very important to her for that reason, something she never got to have. And then, with Madison, the villain, it's like, well, you know, she comes from a very wealthy family. They have a reputation to uphold. It's like, you know, having a child to kind of carry on the family legacy is very important to them. And so I love putting all those little details together. And there are a lot of parts that took a lot of research as far as, you know, like infertility issues and then when it came to the stalking, like I had to research, you know, how do you hack someone's phone, and, you know, how can you clone someone's SIM card and like send them messages and it looks like it's coming from someone else, but it's really from them. And I shouldn't, say any more spoilers, but yeah, it was just all really, really fun.
Did you have all that before you started writing, or did you come up with things as you were writing and have to go back and like seed them?
I did. Yeah. Sometimes I was like, well, you know, if someone were to, you know, send someone a text message and then this happened and that happened, like I was pretty sure that it was something that was possible. So then I had to go and do the research to be like, okay, is this really possible and how would it work? Cause I'm not a super tech savvy person. So, and I got, there's a lawyer that lives in my neighborhood. I interviewed him a little. So he helped me with some of the more legal issues of restraining orders and, you know, what really happens when you get arrested? Like, is it really like you see on Law and Order or, and they're like, no, it's not. Here's how it really goes. You know, and bail and being held and that sort of thing. So it was a lot of fun research.
So what about the choice for a first person point of view? Is that something that came naturally to you, or did you try out different things?
It did come naturally to me. And so with my second book, I actually forced myself to try, like, okay, I did first person point of view for the last one. Like, I want to try third person for this one. And is it third person present or third person past? And it was fun to kind of try with the different styles. But I think first person, and my agent said it too, it just seems to be my strength, where I really like to let the reader know what's going on in their head, that inner monologue. And it just seems to come out the best for me in first person. So I don't know if I'll write all my books in first person, but I'm kind of sticking with it for now. It seems to be my strength, I guess.
Yeah, it's my favorite too. But it's really good for domestic suspense. Right?
Yeah.
You get that close first person. It tends to work really well.
Yeah. And I really like books that go back and forth between multiple points of view, like, you know, this character and then a chapter from this character's point of view. And I really love that because, you know, so much of it is different, you know, based on the point of view and things that this character will pick up on that character doesn't pick up on. It's just so fun to play around with it and try different things.
So that's a really complicated structure. So how do you balance that with pacing when you're writing this? Is this something that's happening more in the editing process to making sure you're giving people the right information at the right time and giving them enough to be able to guess, but not too much?
Yes. I'm going to try to say it without spoiling anything, but the first version, it was all, I can't say that.
No spoilers.
I know. I'm like, how do I say this without spoiling? It's funny. And when the book first came out, I was doing, you know, all the bookstore events where it was like, nobody had read the book. And so, you know, there wasn't, and now I've done a bunch where like book clubs and things where people have read the book and I'm like, oh, this is great. I can just like say it all. But, what was your question?
Pacing. So like you have multiple point of views, you're going back and forth, you know, you're building an architecture of the story. So it's like when the reader learns certain things and how do you do that? Because you're trying to build suspense at the same time. So if you go too long, you crush the suspense. If you go too fast, you don't build it up enough.
Yeah, I think, and I think The Better Mother is a little bit unique in that respect, is that, you kind of see the whole story from one point of view, and not till later do we take you back to the beginning, and then it's like, oh, I didn't pick up on that the first time around, and that the first time around, and oh, I thought that was someone else, and this and that. So that was a really fun way for me to do The Better Mother. I haven't yet done one where it's kind of like alternating chapters. But that's something I'm trying with actually the new work in progress that I'm working on. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, it's good to push yourself, right? Trying
exactly,
new things,
yeah.
Add tools to the kit.
Yeah. And that's, it's funny because, you know, The Better Mother is doing pretty well. You know, it's got a lot of really good reviews and I believe it's selling well. And it makes me so paranoid. Like when you sit down to like write the next thing, it's like, but everyone liked The Better Mother so much. Like, is this too different? Or is that a good thing? Or is it not enough like that? Or, you know, I did first person point of view in that first one, but you see all those blog posts from people who hate first persons, or should I try something else? And the spiraling, you know, it makes me very paranoid. Like I hear a lot of authors who are like, oh, that that first book, that was my one good idea. Like, I don't have any ideas for any other books. That's not me. I have tons of ideas for books that I've got so much notes and everything. And I'm always like, which one do I focus on? But then I get so paranoid thinking like, oh, but they like that. Am I ever going to write something that good again? Yeah.
Welcome to being a writer.
Yeah, so exactly.
We all go through that. But you know, write the story you want to tell. Like, write the one you want to read. Just go with your heart.
Yeah, that's something I'm learning. I'm still really new to this. So that's something I'm having to learn to push through.
All right, we're going to go to questions in just a minute. I have to ask you some process questions.
Of course.
You have so many writers. So were you writing every day?
Most days, but I didn't force it, because times when I did try to force it, I felt like everything that came out was just garbage. So I'm a big proponent of walk away from it, especially if you're having one of those days where like everything you write is terrible and this book is garbage and no one is ever going to want to read this book. Walk away from it for a few days and then come back to it and like reread like the last chapter that you wrote. And almost all the time I'd be like, okay, that's not garbage. I'm actually like, that's pretty good. See, okay, I don't suck. I can do this, you know? And long showers and long walks are like the best things for like solving plot problems. Whenever I couldn't figure out where to take something or how to fix something that was wrong, long shower or a long walk did it for me every time.
Have you ever heard of Aquanotes?
No.
It's a waterproof pad that you stick onto your shower. I was actually writing on it this morning.
Okay, I need one
and
of those.
With a pencil. Because of that, because it's so
somebody
common,
write that
right?
down.
When your subconscious is solving problems and you're letting your mind wander.
That's the best. Because sometimes, you know, you'll be in the middle of doing something and it'll come to you and you'll be like, oh my God, but I'm not in a place where I can write that down right now. So I have a lot of notes just in the notes app in my phone.
That's how I started dictating. Did you ever try dictation as part of this process?
No.
Did you have when you were writing, did you have like a word count or a page count or a number of hours you'd write or anything set? Or did you just write until you felt like you were done?
That. Yeah. Yeah. Until my brain just got too tired and nothing good was coming out. I'd be like, that's enough for today. Some days it would be, you know, multiple chapters, and some days it would be a paragraph. But it's all progress, you know, progress.
Are you old school with pen and paper, or are you writing on a computer?
On the computer, yeah. I especially having been like a journalist, I type so insanely fast that writing with a pen now is so maddeningly slow to me that I can't. Even if it's just one sentence, a note, I'll write it on my computer.
Did you do this in Word or Scrivener, or what was your software?
Just Google Docs, actually, because then, like if I was traveling, I could just kind of continue from anywhere, not have to have that laptop with me. You know, if my laptop crashed or Word crashed, you know, I knew it was saved in the cloud. So, Google Docs is my thing.
Do you listen to music when you write?
I really love music, so that's why I can't listen to it while I'm writing, because I'll just get sucked into the song. So actually, I found some great playlists on Spotify. They have, I think it's called Reading in a Cozy Library. It's all instrumental music. And then I found another one. It's called, I think, Writing in a Library or something. So that one's really good. Yeah, I have to have instrumental, and it has to be kind of mellow. One of my favorite things is to turn on Netflix and, you know, that show Fireplace for Your Home. I love that. It makes you feel like a real author in an English castle, like writing by the fire. And it just like, I'm like, yes, I love that. But then, you can't put it on automatic repeat. So like once an hour, all of a sudden a commercial will come on and like snap you out of it and you have to start it over.
Isn't that the worst when you get pulled out of like the flow state?
I know. I'm like, why can't Netflix needs to fix that?
So one of the questions I always ask people is, where do you think story comes from? And in your case, for this one, you saw a real life thing. But when you're creating these characters and everything, do you feel like you're channeling this stuff? Do you feel like, where does story itself, like fiction, come from? Because these are, even your story, though it was based on something, is fictional and it's a real thing.
I don't know, just the imagination. There, I was never one to use those writing prompts that you see. Like, I don't, it just feels inorganic to me. I love people watching. You know, you ever just go out there in a crowded city and just people watch and, you know, pick up on the emotion on someone's face and be like, I wonder what's wrong. And then you just, oh, maybe this and then that and then that. And it just kind of comes to you that way. Or just a situation. I usually start with a situation. Like, what if somebody had to face this? And that's pretty crazy. And then I think like, well, you know, where would that come from? And then, you know, what happened in that person's life to make them react that way? I guess I reverse engineer a lot.
Yeah, I love that. I do that too. That's great. All right, I'm going to come around if anybody has questions, and I'll give you the mic. Just hold it close so it comes out on the podcast. Any questions? She's on the spot. This is your chance.
What was the best review that you've read of your book? Not the, if they really super loved it, like 7 stars out of 5, but what was the best one that even if it was bad, they put a lot of effort into bringing it across?
Oh gosh. I wish I could quote it because it was just so perfect. It was just someone who was just like, this is, can I swear? Mm-hmm. Okay. This is batshit crazy. And it's like, you know, reading this book was like, you know, somebody came up and like slapped you in the face. And then just as you recover from that slap, then they slap you again. And oh gosh, somebody, they were like a comedian. They really did an amazing job. Some of their reviews.
The one
I saw actually just last night was somebody did a review of my book all in GIFs, and it was just hilarious. They're like, you know, my face when I open up chapter one. Oh, she's finding out she's having a baby. Oh, that's so sweet. And then by like 30% through, you're like, you know, biting your nails. And then by like 50% through, she's like gathering up her guns and her baseball bats and ready to go to battle. And I'm going to kill that woman. And then by the end, it was just like, she was ripping all her hair out and it was just the best. It was just like all in gifts.
That's so much fun. Yeah. Do you have a question?
Tell us about the mocktails.
Oh, yes.
Mocktails. Yes.
The recipes.
Yes, that was one of the most fun things to research for this book. You know, Savannah, our main character, she likes to have her cocktails, but obviously she can't for a while. So she has to find, you know, something else to drink. So she goes out and she tries all these different mocktail recipes. And it was really fun because I wanted to try them. They sounded delicious. And I wanted to make it real. And so I researched and invited some friends over and we tried a bunch of different mocktail recipes. And so some of the best ones went into the book. So those are real mocktail recipes that you can look up. The Fairfax County Public Library were like, we've been wanting to do a series called Mocktails with the Author. And I was like, I've got some mocktail recipes for you. And so it was just perfect the way that worked out.
I have to point out, we have a great mocktail.
You do. I was looking at it. Those sound delicious.
Any other questions here?
So you said you got the story from real life, from Reddit. I was just wondering if you pulled from any other places in your life for characters or character names.
Yeah, it's funny. Everybody reads my book and they're like, that's me, isn't it? And I'll be like, no, but I mean, yes, that was you. After the first version that I wrote, when I knew I had a book deal and it was going to be published, when they had me go back and do a rewrite, make some changes, I purposely changed a lot of the characters' names to name them after people in my life. Cause I was like, you know, I may only get one book out there. I got to put everybody in it. So, yeah, my husband, my friends are in it, my sister, they may not necessarily be a character who's like you, but at least got your name in there. But it's funny that inevitably people will come up to me and be like, oh, that character's me, isn't it? And they'll pick up on the one that I'm like, no, that's nothing like you. Like, that wasn't you, no. They get it wrong.
Any other questions?
Yeah, you had mentioned outlining, and you know, there's that the pantser versus outliner debate. Do you think if you tried another subgenre, you would probably be more of a pantser? I mean, and I'm saying come over to the pantser dark side, but it seems to
I tried. It didn't go very well.
Well, it seems, and this is just my observation. Maybe you know if you have a different view of it. It seems if you have a different kind of subgenre. I mean, mine's noir and hard boiled.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be, if you look at, you know, Dashiell Hammett to Pelicanos, more character driven.
Mm-hmm.
So you can play around with pantsing a little bit more than having to outline every single twist and turn. I mean, but then again, if I'm writing short fiction, I have to be an outliner because you don't have a
right.
lot of...
Can't go off in too many tangents
yeah.
there.
Do you think you'd ever want to try to experiment with something different?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm all about experimenting. And I wouldn't say I'm like 100% a plotter. I like to get like the major milestones. Like, you know, this is the beginning. This is going to be the inciting incident. This is going to be kind of like the height of the drama. This is going to be, you know, the crazy ending. But in between those milestones, I do just kind of let it flow. And sometimes it'll go off in its own direction and I'll end up having to change my outline because I thought of something great because I try to make it feel organic how the characters react to these things that I've planned for them. So I'd say I'm maybe like 75% plotter, 25% pantser. But yeah, with the work in progress, I was just working on, I ended up with a 150,000 word novel, which as most people know is almost twice as long as the publisher wants. You know, the average contemporary novel is like between 80 to 90,000 words. So it was like two books in one and it's so hard to cut it down. It's, you know, it's almost like I might as well just start over, you know.
Some people do that.
Yeah.
Brutal. So where should readers go to find you?
Well, my website is jennifervanderkloot.com, and I'm sure you can't spell that. So JennifervanderKloot, not UET. But it might be easier to find me on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky, TikTok. It's all JennBDK, JennBDK on most socials is what my handle is.
And do you have any events coming up in the near future?
I do. Next week, I'm going to be at the Malice Domestic Mystery Convention in Bethesda, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I'll be at Thriller Fest in New York City, May 7th, 8th, 9th. And then kind of starting a second wave of events. I'll be going to Ohio and South Carolina and Pennsylvania and some fun places. So it's all on my website.
So much fun.
Yes.
So if you guys would do her a favor, go on to Amazon and rate her book. It really helps getting a rating on there. And so people watching us, just take a moment to do that. And if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's, please go to elainesliterarysalon.com and you can rate us on Google or Spotify or wherever it is you rate your stuff. Barnes & Noble's in the other room. It's a good chance to get your book. Please support our bookstores. Get a signed copy. You'll be signing up here, right?
Yes.
All right. Jennifer, thank you so much. This has really been a blast.
And congratulations on your new release as well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Come back for your next book.
I definitely will.
Thank you.
Thank you.